Palestinians and arrested 127 Palestinians, including 13 children, across the West Bank. At the same time, Israel faced an increasing number of resistance operations, up to 19 in 2020 to 98 in 2021. This year, and until the end of September, there have already been around 130 attacks. The Lion's Den has taken heavy casualties, including the heart-stopping footage of Odeh El-Tamimi being martyred following almost a fortnight on the run. But it also reported that a significant number of occupation force casualties resulted from a raid on Nablus in late October, none of which are referred to in the Zionist press. The new, coordinated generation of Palestinian resistance fighters has forced the occupiers to recognize they cannot simply attack with impunity. The occupiers appear to be panicking. The former head of Shin Bet, the Zionist Internal Intelligence Agency, stated in the Zionist press on the 22nd of October, "We are on the brink of a civil war. The Zionist entity is standing on the edge of the abyss, an abyss of internal, social and national disintegration. This is the real existential threat." As the Lion's Den has repeatedly said, current events will answer the question of who is besieging who.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Nadine Keswani, who's a Palestinian organiser from New York City. She's the founder and chair of Within Our Lifetime, United for Palestine. This is a Palestinian-led community-based group whose goal is to revitalise the revolutionary spirit of Palestinians living abroad in pursuit of a free homeland. She's also a student at the City University of New York School of Law, where she organises with Students for Justice in Palestine. And Nadine is a top target for the Zionist movement's racist, defamatory and harassment campaigns in the United States. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. What's the history of the unification of the resistance? For example, why was the May 2021 Unity Intifada so described?
Well, what we saw in May 2021, people might remember, is that there was a big issue around access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And increasingly, the settlers were being allowed access to the mosque. And also, there was a lot of pressure on areas in East Jerusalem, house demolitions, evictions of Palestinians. And that led to a kind of upswelling of anger and of resistance, which cut across normal political divisions. And so people got together and were united in a way which had not been the case for some years prior to that. And that's why it was called the Unity Intifada. And we see that spirit today in the what seems to be the new intifada of people acting across the established political factions to work together to resist the occupation.
Dean, what's the significance, in your opinion, of this statement saying that there's no political project stroke process for the Palestinians?
You know, I think that we've seen over the past few years and few decades, actually, that there is no political process for Palestinians because, you know, the peace talks have failed. Israel's continuously building settlements, killing Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank en masse. And there is no accurate political representative that is actually holding Israel accountable. The Palestinian Authority is not holding Israel accountable, is not representing the aspirations or the desires of the Palestinian people. In fact, they are collaborating with the Zionist entity. And I think that that's something that we're going to touch up on more. But for many Palestinians, we're not seeing any diplomatic or any other way for us to achieve our liberation, for us to achieve rights or even basic human dignity. So the significance of this statement is that because of all of the oppression that Palestinians have been under for over 70 years, the only political process that we've ever seen be effective is through resistance. And we've seen the resistance lead us, you know, through the Intifada, and get us even a seat at the table to begin with. And of course, Oslo was disastrous. I'm not saying that, you know, these peace talks would have brought us peace, but the farcity of them does not even exist anymore. Israel doesn't even pretend to care about the two-state solution or any sort of diplomacy. And we don't have any elected leadership that truly represents our desire for right of return and full liberation of Palestinian land from the river to the sea, except for ourselves, except for, you know, political parties maybe that are considered by the U.S. and Israel to be quote-unquote terrorist groups and not legitimate government representatives. Yeah. So that's how I see it.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Nadine. I mean, David, what do you think explains the huge increase in resistance operations in the current year?
Well, I think coming from what Nadine has been saying, I mean, there is no political process. There is only the possibility of liberation or death. And that's what we see here. We see the huge upswelling of operations, operations which are overwhelming the occupation forces themselves, as they have been saying. Huge increase every day in armed actions across the West Bank. This is not about Gaza, this is about the West Bank in particular. And you see a huge increase in resistance, meaning that there's been a lot more fighters engaged than previously, including fighters from Fatah, the part of the faction which runs the Palestinian Authority. That has led to significant splits and debates inside the Palestinian Authority.
Mm. Indeed. And Nadine, I wonder what you could tell us about the Lion's Den and how it's emerged. And how does it relate, do you think, to previous innovations like the Jenin Brigades?
The Lion's Den emerged as a form of protection for the Palestinian people, especially, you know, in a city like Nablus and many other Palestinian cities, which regularly face raids, incursions, which are regularly under siege. You know, people's homes being demolished. People are assassinated constantly. So the Lion's Den and, you know, similar innovations like the Jenin Brigades, as you mentioned, are really a form of protection for the Palestinian people when there is no one to protect us, when the Palestinian Authority doesn't protect us because they are collaborating with the Zionist entity. So it has emerged because Palestinians are taking matters into their own hands. And we've mentioned the May 2021 Unity Intifada earlier, which really brought Palestinians together in an unprecedented way in recent years. And I think that was the start of what led to the Lion's Den, this hope and reemergence of self-determination, of taking matters into your own hands. You know, as Arab countries continue to normalize around us, we know that nobody's going to give us our liberation. And, you know, the main people that are going to fight for it are ourselves. So it's emerged as a form of protection for the people of those cities, but also as a form of resistance and not just self-defense, actually actively resisting the occupation every day. So, you know, I think that this is going to be continuous until all of Palestine is free, wherever there is oppression or oppression that breeds resistance. And, you know, innovations like the Lion's Den, even if it's wiped out tomorrow, as we see Israel continuously assassinating the leaders and members of the Lions, then innovations like that will continue to pop up as long as we live under occupation, siege, blockade, and, you know, all forms of Zionist settler colonialism and apartheid.
David, let me turn to you again and ask you, what would you say the significance is of the PIJ statement about Fatah when they said, and I'll quote a part of it, they said, "There's nothing between us and the Fatah that resists, that fights. But the Fatah that constitutes the Palestinian Authority have sold themselves to the American project."
Well, here's a very clear statement that the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement is not trying to recruit people from the Palestinian Authority to make their organization bigger. They're saying, no, there is a Fatah which is our ally, which is our comrade, which is the Fatah which fights, which resists. But the Fatah which collaborates with the American project, that is the Fatah which is the opponent of liberation and resistance. So there's a clear split going on inside the Fatah family, if you like. And we've seen that with the Lion's Den and with other similar organizations, where some of the fighters who have been at the forefront of the resistance have been people from Fatah. And of course, what's happened then is that there's been pressure put on the Palestinian Authority to pressure those people who would formerly have been close comrades of the Palestinian Authority people. So there's a really difficult process going on there, of a split of key parts of the authority, of Fatah people coming over to the resistance.
Well, thanks for that. We're going to just pause there for a moment to have a look at this report on the challenges faced by the resistance and the external forces coming to its aid.
As a new intifada rumbles in the West Bank, crucial decisions are being taken and actions made which will affect the likely success of the uprising. A major threat to the resistance is the Palestinian Authority, which collaborates shamelessly with the Zionists. The PA has been exerting maximum pressure on the resistance in close collaboration with the Zionists. Direct death threats to resistance fighters coming from the occupation, with the PA then offering a seeming way out through job offers in the PA security forces. Meanwhile, footage emerged from TikTok of PA security escorting an illegal settler who got lost back to the occupation. Days later, reports also emerged that Mohamed Albana, the brother of the line's then leader, Mahmoud Albana, was tortured to death by the PA. A cache of documents has been leaked on the Palestinian Authority, allegedly showing collaboration of elements of the PA in the death of leader Yasser Arafat. The anniversary of his death is the 11th of November. But the more pressure the settler regime puts on the PA, the more the PA may split apart and fighters are recruited from Fatah to the resistance. As support builds internally, the unity of the resistance is being bolstered by external support. In recent months, the newly unified resistance has overseen rapprochement between Hamas, specifically, and the Syrian Arab Republic, after differences over the Western proxy war against the Syrian government. Here is Hamas Political Bureau member Khalil Al-Khaya speaking in Damascus.
Syria, its people and leadership, all of whom embraced the Palestinian people and were supporters of the resistance. In this heartfelt meeting, we touched upon the president's determination with firm conviction to provide support from Syria to the Palestinian people and their resistance with all capabilities.
A crucial additional dimension to support for the resistance is the central role of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In a major interview on Al Jazeera on October the 23rd, Zaid al-Nakala, Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad Movement in Palestine, stated clearly, Iran is an ally to PIJ and the Palestinian people. It shows solidarity and supports every faction of the Palestinian people. Iran is clear in its stance against Israel and America. Although Iran had the choice to be selfish and think of only defending itself, it continuously provides support to our cause. Iran also provides military support and strategic expertise to the resistance forces, and Hamas enjoys the lion's share of their support. Iran only has honest intentions in aiding us with our liberation.
David, the film there seemed to suggest that the Palestinian Authority is up to its neck in collaboration with the Israeli regime. Don't you say that's a fair characterization?
I'm afraid it is. I mean, the authority itself is deeply involved in Israeli security apparatus. And what you've been seeing in recent weeks in Nablus and other areas is that the Israelis threaten individual fighters with death, and then the Palestinian Authority goes in, contacts them, and sometimes meets with these people and offers them jobs in the PA security apparatus. And so it's a coordinated strategy where there's a very, very close collaboration between the Israelis and the Palestinian Authority. And, of course, that's a really problematic issue, especially given many of the people in the Fatah faction are joining and are involved in the resistance.
Indeed. I mean, Nadine, how would you describe the role of the Palestinian Authority in the current circumstances?
Unfortunately, the Palestinian Authority continues to collaborate with Israel, as I mentioned earlier. And there have actually been recent reports of members of the Lions then surrendering themselves to the Palestinian Authority, which, you know, we don't know how that's going to turn out. But we've seen in the past, you know, resistance figures and fighters who are actively fighting for the liberation of Palestine being undermined by the Palestinian Authority, imprisoned, beaten up and even killed. So we know where their loyalties lie. They are heavily funded by the U.S. They collaborate with the U.S. and Israel, and they're influenced by that. And they wouldn't be in power if they weren't, to be frank, because we know that there's no such thing as actual democratic elections in Palestine, because when the U.S. and Israel and other countries don't like the result, they'll just form a coup. So, you know, I think that we haven't had elections in over 10 years. And at this point, the Palestinian Authority is less concerned with actually representing the interests of its people versus doing what it needs to do in order to maintain power and maintain survival and stay on the side of the U.S., of Israel, that allows them to exist in this current form. So, unfortunately, many Palestinians feel betrayed by the Palestinian Authority. And I've even heard stories of people who say that they would rather be arrested and killed by the Zionist enemy than have their own people place them in the line of fire. So we've known that the PA has delivered Palestinians to be jailed in Israeli jails, has delivered Palestinians that have been on hunger strike. So, you know, even though Palestinian people who are actively taking on this resistance are getting popular support from the people of Palestine, I don't have trust in the Palestinian Authority to actually reflect that and respect, you know, these people for putting their lives on the line for our collective liberation. And I just see them continuously collaborating with the Zionist project moving forward, even if they pay lip service sometimes here and there, you know, to the broader Palestinian struggle.
No, it's a terrible tragedy. But David, what's the significance of this meeting in Damascus with President Assad?
It's hugely significant because Hamas had fallen out quite badly with the Syrian government. They are now back in the fold, and it means that there's a unity there with Syria, Iran, Hezbollah, Ansar Allah in Yemen, and the popular mobilization units in Iraq. I mean, it means a unity across the whole of the resistant community in West Asia.
I mean, I wonder whether you could also tell us, David, I mean, that interview with the leader of the PIJ is interesting in that it claims that Iran is selfless in supporting the resistance. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, there's a lot of feeling in the West, I think, on the left, of people who think that Iran and Syria are not really anti-imperialist countries. They're really not properly supporting the resistance. But if really the answer to that question is you ask what the resistance in Palestine says, and you've got the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, perhaps the most radical of the factions there, saying, look, Iran doesn't have to be doing this. It's doing this selflessly, and it's supporting the resistance in a comprehensive way, meaning not just political support, but also directly military and strategic support as well. And so that's an indication really of what's happening in Palestine, is that the resistance, which is unified internally, also has increasingly unified external support from Syria and indeed from Iran. And that's a really significant factor in what's going to happen next.
I mean, and finally, Nadine, what lessons should the Palestine solidarity movement draw in the West, do you think?
I think one of the most important lessons, you know, I've seen over my time in the Palestine movement, at least here in the U.S., is that, you know, we should never try to make our movement palatable for Western consumption just for that sake. We should never undermine the role of the resistance or hyper-focus on, you know, this human rights discourse that just places us as passive victims, because we are not that. We are fighters. We are resisting. And I think that that's something that's beautiful and that should be celebrated by people in the West. And just because, you know, we're labeled as terrorists by countries like the U.S. and Israel, we have to reject that notion. We look at, you know, how the world reacted to Ukrainians, and they were calling them freedom fighters, even using a picture of Ahed Tamimi claiming that she was a Ukrainian girl fighting for freedom, when in reality she was a Palestinian girl who had actually served 8 months sentence in prison for slapping an Israeli soldier that kicked her off of her land. So we know that the world understands this concept of freedom fighters, But unfortunately, they never placed that when it onto the Palestinian people or oppressed people in general. They never look at us through that lens, and we don't need them to, but we should never undermine our own people, our struggle, our cause, to try to fit it into this Western standard that's never going to accept us to begin with. It's our role to represent the principles of our people back home, to honor them to the highest degree, to understand that those who are resisting are not terrorists. They're defending their right to a future. They're defending the right for their mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, children to live in peace and dignity, free of harm, free of settler colonialism, occupation, apartheid practices, siege, blockade, constant bombardment, bombings, killings. So I think that we have to focus on these principles, remain steadfast. We know that the world is taking a while to catch up to the Palestine struggle and understand that we will be liberated, and we must be liberated by any means necessary, but we will get there. And we're seeing that shift happen. And the only way that we can make that shift happen is if us, the people who are building the movement, actually uphold these principles. Because if we're not the ones upholding them, who will? So I think that this isn't just for people in the U.S. This is for people who are in solidarity with Palestine across the world. We take our lessons and our cues from those who are most directly affected on the ground and those who are resisting the occupation by any means necessary.
No. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time. So that's it for today's show. I hope you found the program informative. Thanks to our guest, Nadine Keswani, and our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah.
This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. We are proud of all our infallible imams, peace be upon them, and devoted to following them. We are honored that all of our infallible imams, peace be upon them, who suffered in prisons and exiles, finally became martyrs as a result of attempting to eradicate oppressive governments and taghuts of their own time in order to raise the status of Islam and to implement the teaching of Holy Quran, who of those aspects is to establish a just government. Today we are honored that we are determined to implement the concepts of glorious Quran and those of traditions.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the prayers and supplications. In one of his speeches, he mentioned that at any rate, there are unprecedented subtleties in these holy prayers. Heed them well, they can make men move. Now, in this part of his speech, he is talking about the importance of the prayers and supplications. For example, we have special prayers and supplications for the night of Friday, like Dua-i Kumail. We have Munajat Sha'baniya, which we recite in the month of Sha'ban. There are prayers or supplications in the month of Ramadan. There are other prayers like the day of Arafah when we read the dua which was recited by Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So Imam Khomeini is talking about the importance of all these supplications, these prayers
that he said that they have unprecedented subtleties in them. We need to be aware of those. That's why he said, heed them well. Don't be heedless. We need to have the awareness of those things, the points which are said in there. And these are those points which can make a man move.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. Sallallahu alayhi. Salli ala.
When we refer to the book which is known as Sahifa Sajjadiyya, which is the supplication and prayer book of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam, when we look at that, there are many things that motivate men to move forward, that gives hope to the men, that tells us which way we need to follow, that guides us where we need to go. Therefore, it is necessary that when we are saying the prayers or the supplications, we know what do they mean. Generally, we have seen that people are mostly like they're after reciting or reading the prayers or supplications in the Arabic language because it's been narrated in the books the same way. But it is also necessary to know the meaning of what we are saying. Yes, it is right. We need to read it in Arabic. Its meaning or what it aims to say that can be said perfectly in Arabic. But if we know the meaning, we can get closer to the things. Because when we know the meaning, we know what we are asking from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, what we are saying to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When we are talking to Allah, how we are talking and what are we saying. So we do understand what we want. And therefore, we need to pay attention to the prayers and the supplications, inshallah.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Election in the occupied Palestinian territories means holding a ceremony to replace a war criminal with another, and this time the terrorist racist Netanyahu has come to power. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, "For Palestinians, the Zionist regime election results are familiar and meaningless. One set of war criminals has been replaced by another known to Palestinians as an unabashed racist and terrorist, Benjamin Netanyahu. He also faces criminal charges for graft and fraud. What else is new, and what are such charges in the face of the much weightier issue of returning to power in the Zionist snake pit? Besides the block of racists and bigots that Netanyahu leads, plans to remove the offense of fraud and breach of trust from the criminal code. This is what Netanyahu was on trial for. This will be among the first order of business if Netanyahu and his Likud bloc are able to cobble together the requisite number of seats in parliament," Kenneth said. On the basis of word count, he seems set to return to power. His disastrous rule for Palestinians of 12 years was brought to an end in March 2021 by an unlikely alliance of former Netanyahu allies. But they soon fell out because they had little in common, necessitating another election on November 1st. Before the Western corporate media indulges in its customary jingoism proclaiming the non-existent virtues of the only democracy in the West Asia region, let us remember that the fabricated regime of Israel is ruled by gangsters and hustlers. For the Palestinians under occupation, it makes little difference who rules the snake pit. After all, the just-defeated coalition led by Yair Lapid spared no effort to torture, maim, and kill Palestinians to prove his macho credentials. It was under his watch that Jenin and Nablus have suffered prolonged sieges and killings. Lapid also ordered a three-day attack on Gaza in early August after arresting an Islamic Jihad activist in Jenin. Illegal Zionist squatters from the US and Europe routinely barge onto the Masjid al-Aqsa compound. Displaying this behavior and under the protection of the heavily armed Israeli regime forces, they have attacked and killed Palestinians on the sacred compound. And this and more has happened under Lapid's watch. So what will change for the Palestinians if a well-known terrorist, Netanyahu, becomes the prime minister of the illegitimate entity? Nothing, except that Netanyahu indulges in terrorist acts with a scowl while his predecessor did it with a smile. The election campaign was also marred by vicious personal attacks on political opponents. If non-Jews were to repeat what they called their opponents, they would be immediately accused of anti-Semitism. Yet, the animosity between them runs so deep that had it not been for the Palestinians, they would be drinking each other's blood. That explains why the Zionists will never make peace with the Palestinians. The Zionist regime is not a democracy. It has never been. It is a colonial settler entity established on land stolen from the Palestinian people. Throughout its 74-year existence, the fabricated regime of Israel has indulged in horrific crimes against innocent Palestinians. In recent weeks and months, such attacks have escalated. No change in the Zionist regime policy toward the Palestinians can be expected under Netanyahu. In fact, the oppression of Palestinians will intensify. The terrorist Itamar Ben-Gvir, who emerged from the bowels of the fascist Kach movement, is likely to get a cabinet post in Netanyahu's regime. Netanyahu has vowed to expand the illegal Zionist settlements in the West Bank, and Ben-Gvir has publicly called for killing Palestinians. While the Palestinians long for peace and an end to their suffering, they will achieve neither. The only choice left for them is to continue the resistance by whatever means necessary. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, for Palestinians on the ground, the election is likely to bring more tensions, but no real substantial change. After all, the fabricated regime of Israel was freely expanding settlements, detaining and killing Palestinians while demolishing their homes under the previous anyone but Netanyahu coalition. Nevertheless, the electoral triumph of Ben-Gvir is a further embarrassment for the international community, that is, Western countries led by the U.S. that are the main sponsors of the Oslo Accords, who will now have to justify their support for an Israeli regime government that unashamedly contradicts U.S. and international policy.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to deal with an important subject of hijab according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But let's listen to a short biography before we start our program. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Well, we are still talking about hijab, this important subject, as the rest of the questions remained from the previous, in fact, episodes. Let me ask you, Sheikh Javid, about overgarments. You know, the community has become familiar with many types of these kinds of garments that we call overgarments or abaya, right? Abaya are known by various names, but they serve the same purpose, which is basically to cover all parts of the body, right?
Yeah.
Contemporary models, though, are usually kaftans cut from light, flowing fabrics, like crepe, georgette, and chiffon. Well, other known styles are front open and front closed overgarments. Styles differ from region to region, as everybody knows, right?
Yeah.
What is the opinion of the Islamic legislator, you know, in this or about this phenomenon? What is the difference between abaya and what is called manto that some women wear when traveling?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The Islamic hijab means the modest covering of the body by a woman, including her hair and face and hands from the sight of a non-mahram man, of course. As for how a woman should cover her body, and how her body should be, you know, dressed, it is something that that is relegated to the woman herself. It is something that the woman herself can choose, you know, the type of the dress, the clothing, because Islam does not prescribe a special type of clothing or dress. The dress, as we said in the one of the previous episodes, differs from one culture, from one community, and from one country to another country. So as we say, as we go to different countries, we find women wearing clothes with different designs, you know, patterns. And so the type of the dress is relegated to the woman herself, provided that the dress the woman wears, of course, is not, you know, flashy, it's not attractive, it's not, you know, the dress of fame, it's not see-through. Mm-hmm. These are the most important conditions that must be considered and must be taken into account by a woman. If these conditions are fulfilled, then the woman should not worry about the type of the dress she wears.
Mm-hmm, I see. Another question, Sheikh Shawid, is that what is the religious law about a woman wearing clothes that are transparent, revealing the body parts, clothes fitting, or clothes of bright colors such as yellow and red, ornate, gilded, embroidered, flashy in terms of how it looks, and shiny and silky?
Well, what is required of a woman in hijab is to cover her attractive parts,
mm-hmm,
and to hide her adornment from strangers. That's very important because Almighty Allah says they must not display their adornments. لَا يُبْدِينَ زِينَتَهُنَّ. Okay? That's what the Quran says. And the women should not display or show their adornments, their ornaments, whatever. And therefore, whatever clothes meet this requirement,
yes,
it is permissible, as long as the clothes do not, reveal the woman's attractive parts, as long as they are not see-through, as long as they are loose. Of course, there's no objection to the woman wearing them,
mm-hmm,
wearing them. Of course, the more modest the cloth is in common view, the better it is.
Mm-hmm. How about shiny and silky?
Of course, women wear shiny and silky clothes. Women can wear silk. There is no objection to women wearing silk.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, silk is haram for men only.
And also gold,
but when it comes to a cloth being shiny, of course, it depends in common view. If in the eye of custom, or in common view, of course, a dress is considered to be the dress of fame or attractive, very flashy, and very kind of weird in common view, then it's not permissible to wear that dress.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Ashwid. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the Library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohan Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Shawid, our guest speaker. The topic is still hijab, that we are asking many questions about it. Sheikh Shawid, let me ask you a question about the relationship between custom and hijab. Does custom, do you think, have any role to play in determining the type of hijab women should wear?
Well, custom is the word used to refer to the believers or common people's understanding of something. Now, when we talk about custom, we mean we do not mean every individual. Every individual who lives in a city. There are people who do not care about, clothing. There are people who are not practicing Muslims. There are Muslims and non-Muslims in a city. So we don't. Custom does not refer to such kind of common understanding. When we talk about custom, we mean the custom of the believing and faithful people, those who are practicing, those who pray, those who fast, and those who actually abide by the Islamic laws. That's what custom means, of course. Now, when it comes to the customs having a role in determining the type of the the hijab, of course, the custom may have a say in matters regarding clothes, whether they are sexually provocative, whether they are, you know, flashy or not. Because it's the custom that decides whether it is flashy or not. If it is flashy, and if it is, you know, sexually provocative, then obviously she must not wear them.
Mm-hmm. I see. And another question, Shastavid, about the work situation. You know, some women have to work, all right? They have to earn their livelihood. So what is the ruling on a woman working with men if she's taking care of her hijab, but that work requires a mixing of women and men, you know, in the same place, looking at other people's faces, for example, and talking to them? So there is a kind of interaction between women and men in their workplace.
Well, Islam is not opposed to men and women interacting with each other. Islam is not opposed to it. Of course, women in this time around do go out working because they have to support their children, they have to help their husbands. Sometimes they might have ailing husbands in their...
Sometimes they are single parents.
Sometimes they are single parents, as you said. And therefore, they need to work. And of course, according to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, there is no objection to a woman going out and working. Of course, if she is married, she must get her husband's consent, because she cannot leave her home without the consent of her husband. Now, if her husband gives his consent and allows her to go out, of course, it depends, again, it depends on the setting or the environment in which she might work, okay? If she is exposed to some kind of danger, for example, she must not work there, because it's very important for a woman to be able to observe her hijab and to abide by the Islamic Sharia laws. And of course, generally speaking, if her working does not entail any evil, anything haram, then there's no problem in her work. She can work wherever it is safe, and wherever she can observe hijab, and wherever she is confident that she will not fall into a sin.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you very much, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the team here in this program Islamic Laws, we bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو رحيم محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.